There will be no laughter.
Ever.
Ever. Hello and welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, and on Twitter at Literary Italy. Our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. Our email address is mail@literaryitaly.com. We love hearing from listeners.
We love it.
If you enjoy our podcasts, please subscribe or follow us using your podcast app. I have to say subscribe or follow us because I think Apple changed the terminology because people thought they'd be paying. Our podcast is entirely free.
Right. Yeah. Free to listen.
So if you can subscribe or follow us on your app, that really helps us. Also, please consider giving us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts, at Google, or wherever you're getting this podcast. Spread the word. Hi, Anne.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
All right. Okay. I'm doing okay.
Good.
Glad to be back.
Very good to be back.
Glad, as always, to be talking about Italy and Italian literature and a fantastic author, Dacia Maraini. Was probably one of the most well-known female Italian authors outside of Italy after Elena Ferrante now. Right. But I think it's important to perhaps, you know, she's had a long career and she's extremely prolific. So for some people, I'm sure that we're introducing her, but for other people, I'm sure they're like, oh yeah, I know Maraini. So we're still going to be talking about Sicily.
Yeah.
And because Maraini's mother was from Sicily. She's born 1936. Her mother is a Sicilian princess. So she could wear one of those necklaces and that says in rhinestones, principessa, princess, Topazia Aliata di Salaperuta, which I just love that name, Topazia as a first name. Yeah. Her father is Fosco Maraini from Fiesole. And again, the author's name is Dacia Maraini. So Dacia is spelled D-A-C-I-A. Maraini is M-A-R-A-I-N-I. Just because it might not, you know, you hear it, you might not know exactly how you would spell it.
And what are we reading today?
Today we're reading her book, her autobiographical novel called Bagheria. And Bagheria is also the town, as I said, where her mother was from and where she spent some of her childhood. So let's go to her childhood. She has a fascinating, convoluted upbringing.
Don't we all?
Not as fascinating and convoluted as this one. So her father, Fosco Maraini, was from Florence and from Fiesole, I think he was born there. And he was an ethnologist. Specifically, he studied Tibetan culture, Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. He's the son of a sculptor, and his mother was an artist as well. You know, the whole family was very artistic. Mm-hmm. And just visual arts, literary arts, and also very open-minded, outside.
It sounds very aristocratic, if that makes, but in a kind of, how can I say, an elite, they're not manual laborers.
They're very
highly
mother,
cultured and from kind of royalty, literally, right? I mean, principessa.
Well, so her mother's side, yes. And they're certainly unconventional for their time. They travel a whole lot. This is Maraini's parents.
Right.
They travel a whole lot. And as I said, her father was an expert in Japanese culture. And in 1938, with fascist Italy beginning to become more and more oppressive, he and his wife and baby Dacia left Italy for Japan. 1938, he had a position, I think a teaching position there. And I don't know if it's out of the frying pan into the fire, but it's certainly out of the frying pan into another frying pan, put it that way. And in 1943, when the puppet state of the Republic of Salò, the propped up Mussolini government, came into power, they, as foreigners in Japan, were asked to sign a recognition of this state as being the official state of, or the, what's it, the legitimate state of Italy. And they refused. And so they were, the whole family, so that's the parents, Dacia, mm-hmm. and now her two younger sisters who were born in Japan, were put placed in a concentration camp from 1943 until the end of the war in Nagoya. So the first part of Bagheria, I think she does talk about this childhood in Japan and some of her memories. Now, keeping in mind, she's very young, but her memories of the concentration camp, in particular, starvation, hunger.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like an ongoing, I think when you have an episode in your life of such deprivation, it, you never forget it. Right. I mean, that she certainly seems to remember.
Yeah. Literal malnutrition, things like beriberi and.
Yeah. And the worms.
The worms.
Yeah. You can't, the children having worms. After they were released, you know, after the end of the war and they were released from the concentration camp, they went as a family to Sicily, back to this town of Bagheria, and to the family villa. And it was a little bit of a shock, I think, for the young Dacia to see, you know, coming from this upbringing, which was very, I don't know, progressive, mm-hmm. very, very open to the world, to see this very closed culture in this small town in Sicily. It's a small town. So Bagheria, we're going to talk about it as a, you know, as a tourist destination in a little bit. It really, I mean, it's a small town, but it's on the outskirts of Palermo. So it's not like it's in the middle of nowhere, but it is very closed, especially for women, you know, so very tightly regulated for women as far as where they could go. Who they could be seen by. You know, they would not be leaving the home except in the presence of another family, you know, a man, like a father or a brother. So I think it was a bit of a shock for the young Marini. And it was a shock, I think, for her to see her mother go back into this world. Shortly after that, her parents separate. They don't divorce until, I don't know, I mean, after divorce is legal. So divorce is not legal in Italy until, I think, 1970 or thereabouts. So they separate, but she eventually does leave and she goes to Florence where her father is. And that's where she receives her schooling.
Now her father has gone off to do research. Is that he's been continuing with his work while he's...
And yes, and his academic work. Yeah. He's also quite a bit of a traveler. He was also known as a mountaineer. He did, I think he hiked. No, maybe he didn't hike K2. But anyway, he did a number of... You know, he was kind
Alpine
of a,
kinds of things.
And she has she talks about it very frankly. I mean, she has a real infatuation with her father. Yeah. And she talks about him as, you know, he is her first love. You know, and I think that we can kind of see, she talks about that with when she talks later on. She had a long, over 20-year relationship with the writer, the Roman writer Alberto Moravia, 1962 to 1983. And she talks about him, too, as a kind of daddy lover figure. So... She gets into a lot of that with this book, just her complicated feelings, also a feeling of abandonment from her father when he left, you know, that to be left in this town in Sicily, which was so foreign to this 10-year-old Dacia who had grown up in Japan and, you know, had a very different upbringing. And then her father leaves and I think it's a little bit, you know, she talks a little bit about this. But at the same time, the history of her own family is so rich and there's so much, you know, it's sort of the beauty, the beautiful and the ugly that's there. And I think she tries to convey that in this book, Bagheria. Yep. So she's receives a good education. She begins to write. She has a brief marriage in the 50s to a painter from Milan, Lucio Pozzi. But as I said, in 1962, she begins a relationship with Alberto Moravia, who you might remember. I don't remember what episode. We talked about him. Yeah. We also talked about Elsa Morante, who was his wife. So he, at the time, was married to Elsa Morante. He left Morante when he began this relationship with Marini. Again, he and Elsa Morante were not actually divorced until, I think, 85, but they were separated. Mm-hmm. So through Moravia... She developed more friendships with Italian and other intellectuals, you know, worldwide intellectuals. And she began her writing career really around the same time, 1962, and kind of hit the world, you know, hit the writing world with a bang, you know, mm-hmm. right from the get-go. And her works kind of go through various stages, but I would say overall, certainly the themes, her major theme has to do with women and personal freedom. So I would say she's a feminist author. It's her writing tends to be about giving voice to women who otherwise either their stories are neglected or they're distorted by being told by someone else. Mm-hmm. So she tries to kind of, you know, enable this kind of this way of, I don't know, telling the stories of these silent women.
And this is also in part her story, in as much as she's a novelist, her ancestor, she's written a novel before this memoir about that, and in an attempt to, you were telling me earlier.
Yeah, to tell the story. So probably her most, I think Bagheria is 1993
yeah.
published. 1990, she publishes a book called La Lunga Vita di Mariana Ucria, which gets translated, or is in English, the title is The Silent Duchess. And that's probably that's the one that you'll probably be able to find if you're looking at it in a bookstore, looking right. for her in a bookstore in your library. It is an historical fiction.
Right.
About one of her own ancestors. It's The Silent Duchess. It takes place in the 18th century. I think it's her great
one of her
grandmother. But anyway, one of her ancestors who was deaf mute. And the story is, it's kind of told, again, she's trying to tell the story of this woman
right.
who can't communicate, you know, who can't speak. But she's also talking about how Mariana Ucria gains a voice through her writing.
Yes.
So at a time when women were typically not very well educated because she cannot speak, because she apparently is a deaf mute, Mariana Ucria is given the tools to learn to read and to write. And she reads tremendously. Kind of spoiler, but she ends up at the age of 13 being married to her uncle, and what's revealed is that her uncle was also her rapist. Mm. And so it's that rape, which is the trauma that that caused her to lose her voice.
Right. There's a bit in the, just, there is in the memoir as well, in Bagheria, there's sexual abuse as
Of a child. Of yes. A child,
of Dacha.
And she talks about it. She writes about it in this very, well, why not? I mean, I was going to say a very brutal way, but why not?
Matter of factly.
Right. Very matter of factly, because as a child, she doesn't really realize what's going on. Yeah. So, but she is writing about it from the point of view of an adult who now mm-hmm. realizes that this family friend was
right.
was abusing her. Yeah. And so with The Silent Duchess, there is this brutality what's the word? Like the hypocrisy of this world, this very well, this highly controlled world. You know, as I said, she's married to this uncle, you know, she calls her uncle husband. I think she actually continues to call him uncle husband, and bears children, some of whom, you know, one of whom dies from disease, you know, lots of tragedy. But in the end, she kind of does find her voice through writing, and eventually does fall in love for real, has a real relationship, and kind of finds herself in her personhood and also in her sexuality as well. I mean, rather than have that sexuality taken from her, you know, literally like raped and then having to bear children with someone that she not only does not love, but is her uncle and is her abuser. She ends up like this, she ends up with a love affair that actually comes from her, where she is the protagonist, you know, rather than the object. This is also another theme in much of Maraini's writing, is to try to give voice to these otherwise silent or neglected women. Maybe neglected isn't really the right word, but distorted. So she has other books that retell, for instance, the story of Clytemnestra, from her point of view, or Veronica Franco, who is a famous Venetian courtesan. And also she has a book of about Clara of Assisi. I can't remember the title of it. So she kind of sees these, they're fairly well-known women, but kind of takes their stories on to say there's more to it than the books that were written about them, usually by men. Obviously, Clytemnestra, Clara of Assisi with her her hagiography. So she's a winner of the Strega Prize. I think we mentioned that for the La Lunga Vita di Mariano Cria. Also the Premio Campiello, which is another famous, important mm-hmm. Italian, many, many prizes.
All right, she was a nominee for the Man Booker Prize in the UK as well.
Yeah, and she's been shortlisted for the Nobel Prize in Literature at least 1 year for sure. Maybe someday she'll get it. She's also, though, she's also a poet and has very big, I don't know how many plays, but has written many, many plays. And she really saw or sees, I mean, she's still alive. She sees the stage as an important way to kind of bring about social awareness, political awareness, and change. And participation. And so she does kind of, you know, she's very, as I said, very prolific. She travels the world, interviewed by many, many different people. And she kind of talks about the way that with the stage, with the play, you actually have audience, like you can actually see it. You see people's reaction. And people are kind of performing, they're participating, the audience is also participating in the play as well. So the novels.
Shall we talk?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, no. I was gonna wonder if you wanted to talk. It's okay to take a breath.
No, there's something else I was gonna say, and I just forgot.
I know you don't need to though.
All right.
So, do we want to talk about Bagheria the place, not just Bagheria the memoir?
Of course.
Or do you want to talk a little bit more about Maraini?
Well, I wanted to mention. Well, we're gonna talk about Bagheria the place. Okay, that's the name of the book. That is also the place, this town on the outskirts of Palermo. Mm-hmm. Initially, I had thought, oh, we'll talk about Palermo. But the more I kind of looked into Bagheria, I thought, no, I think we got enough right here. We can do Palermo with another writer who's more specifically, just because she is so attached to this town of Bagheria. And I think it's worthwhile visiting for its own sake. You know, and perhaps more than just a day, you know, a afternoon from Palermo. So Bagheria is about 6 miles to the east of Palermo on the northern coast of Sicily. And it's best known for a number of villas mm-hmm. from 18th century, including her, you know, her own family's villa. And that's what she talks about in this book, this villa that's falling to pieces because they can't keep it up anymore.
Right.
And these villas were built by these feudal lords that lived in Palermo, but they had these houses in just outside of Palermo to kind of get away from the heat and the crowds of the city, especially in the summer. Because of these villas, it became kind of a stopping place, a touristic stopping place, including on the Grand Tour. So what's the Grand Tour? We should do an episode on the Grand Tour. That would be interesting. So the Grand Tour was kind of a, I don't know, what would you say, tradition, a movement, mm-hmm. A phenomenon of in between the 17th and early 19th century of kind of well-bred, well-educated European families sending their children, but young adult children.
It was a scholarly coming of age ritual.
It was basically your rail.
Right.
It was like your rail without the train.
But to kind of experience European culture.
Yeah, it was, or maybe like a study abroad, like we might say study abroad programs,
right.
Kind of try to do the same thing,
yep.
Where you go abroad, where they would go and really travel for, you know, we're going to spend 2 months in Florence, we're going to spend 2 months in Rome, spend that whole year. So typical cities, it was almost always a given. You were going to go to Paris, you were going to go to Rome.
Uh-huh.
Venice definitely became part of the Grand Tour. Florence did, Vienna, you know, there were a bunch, but Naples, often they didn't go any farther south than Naples. But if they did get down to Sicily, Bagheria was on the route for mm-hmm. sure because of these villas and because of their importance. Goethe writes about Bagheria. Perhaps the most famous villa in Bagheria, one of the most famous villas in Italy, is the Villa Palagonia, which was built in 1715. And it's very over-the-top Sicilian Baroque style. But it's known as the Villa of Monsters, the Villa dei Mostri, because the subsequent owner, the prince who owned it mid-18th century, embellished it. Mm. He's like, oh, it was already built, but he decorated it with these sculptures of grotesque animals, monsters, mythical stories and creations. So it's a famous, famous villa, kind of a must-see in Bagheria. It's also known for, there's a Hall of Hercules that has all, you know, his various, the labors of Hercules, but also the Hall of Mirrors, which is a large hall, I think like a dance hall, that's where the ceiling is all mirrored. Not just one big mirror, because they didn't have that then, but many multiple mirrors so that you could look up and you see, you know, almost like a fun house. You see yourself
multiple
reflect.
Hands.
Yes, multiple hands. So it always looks crowded in that hall, even if there are only two or three people. Okay. In addition to Dacia Marini, the Bagheria also was the hometown of the Italian neorealist painter Renato Guttuso, whose villa was the Villa Cattolica. So that's another, you know, there's a bunch of villas to visit. Uh-huh. And probably more better known to an American audience, it's also the hometown of the film director Giuseppe Tornatore. And he's best known, at least in the United States, for his movie Cinema Paradiso, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film in 1990. So Cinema Paradiso, if you haven't seen it, you know, I highly recommend it. I think I've seen it like 10 times, you know, and I always cry at the end. Is the story of a boy who grows up in a small town, and it's not called Bagheria, but it is Bagheria, and some of it was filmed there. And he grows up sort of infatuated with the movies, and he's an orphan. His father dies in World War II, and he's kind of taken under the wing of the town's movie, the projectionist for the town's movie theater. And that's really like the only entertainment for this town. You know, there's no TV, there's no internet or anything like that. The importance of that town cinema. And as I said, Tornatore, that movie really kind of marked also a return to Italian cinema, at least on the international stage. It was not, it actually didn't do that well in Italy, but they edited it, you know, because it was a long movie. Yeah. It is a long movie still, but it was over, I think, 2.5 hours. They cut about half an hour off. I've seen the longer version. I don't think it's essential, and I think cutting it was actually a good choice. But and once they cut it and it distributed around the world, it was a huge hit. In addition, what are some of the other?
Did it win the Oscar that year?
Yes. Yeah, 1990, Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. He's also director of the movie Stanno Tutti Bene with Marcello Mastroianni, They're All Doing Fine. Is that the way it's translated?
Everybody's fine,
which I think was remade into a movie with Robert De Niro.
Yeah, I can't remember
years
the name
later,
of that one.
Yeah. Malena is another one of his movies. What are some of the others?
Oh, Bagheria, which is again set.
Yes. So Bagheria is perhaps an original or variation of the name for the town Bagheria.
Mm-hmm. He features his home pretty prominently in his work. It's something he returns to.
Well, and that's what we were just looking. So Tornatore is born 1956, and it does strike me that it seems that someone who's in his 30s has such a nostalgic feeling toward his child, toward, I shouldn't say it's his childhood, because he's born in 1956. The story does take place in the 40s, but this nostalgia for childhood.
But that you can hit that fairly young. right? I mean, you can have a nostalgia for your childhood. I'm going to take us completely out of Italian literature and just say the Beatles' big double single in 1967 was Strawberry Fields, which was John's recollection of his youth, and Penny Lane, which was Paul's recollection of his youth. That sort of thing can hit you.
Yeah.
Once you get out of childhood, there's a strong pull there.
Well, and I think also as a director, the nostalgia for the early years of cinema, even if those were not the years that you were living. I mean, we, you know, you and I, Jim, we enjoy watching these classic movies from the 30s and 40s. I think even our kids do. I mean, we've kind of foisted them on them, like when they realize, wait, movies actually come in color, you know?
I feel like when we ask them if they enjoy it, they deny it. And yet it keeps coming back for things that they actually want to see again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, you make us watch all these old movies, and then it's...
But I think for a director to see those early movies is important. Like, you would feel a sense of nostalgia. Yeah. This very early use of this medium.
Right. And I think film kind of lends itself to that. I think movies kind of...
And it's telling stories. Yeah. You know, that's Cinema Paradiso is about that, about how you tell these stories. And it is also, there is a story. There's a love affair. And the love affair is actually, I would say, maybe secondary to the love affair of cinema is perhaps more important to that movie than the love affair with the woman.
Right. So I've seen it a couple times, and I'll be honest. I have trouble remembering all the details of the story. The thing that love story I never remember. The thing I remember is, you know, it's about a projectionist, right?
Yeah.
And how, you know, there's the church censor who insists that anything vaguely lustful, it must be edited out. So they wind up clipping all the parts where people kiss. And as a present, doesn't the projectionist edit all that together? Yeah. So it's nothing but people kissing. It's so sweet. It's such a sweet, and it's also like a great commentary on the power of cinema in general.
Yeah. Just the, really beautiful. that unifying, you know, and again, that relationship between the young Totò, that's the name of the boy who grows up to be the character in the movie, and the projectionist.
So tackling this was, for me, was really great, just because Bagheria, for me, I'd never heard of the town, and I had no idea that I'd already seen it a couple times in
Yes,
film.
In addition, it's also in, I think, Godfather 2, you know, those are movies that I've seen that I have no interest in seeing again.
I think Godfather 1 is the one where they go. Where Michael goes to Sicily.
All right, so then it's in it's in the Godfather 1, which actually is 50 years old this year. Yep.
Wow.
1972.
Wow.
Yeah. So in addition to kind of neat things to see in Bagheria and some of the history of it, food. You know, so we're always going to talk about food. So what we, and
all
actually two
and
of the
food,
two of the things, two of the foods that we most, I, we, this is like everyone in the world, two, that I associate with Sicily, Sicilian style pizza.
Sure.
Now, what is that? You know, we're here, we get this deep dish. It's not Chicago style, but a thicker crust than what you would get in, you know, Naples has a kind of a chewy crust. It's not thin, but Sicilian style, you know, maybe a centimeter
and
high.
The Italian term for it's sfincione.
Sfincione is this pizza,
right?
And apparently, supposedly, was invented in Bagheria.
Right. And when I looked for it on the interwebs, I saw alto e croccante, which is to me like the perfect Sicilian pizza, which, because when it's too dough,
it should be mushy, high, right?
It's thick, but it should have some crispiness at the bottom, some crunchiness, so that it's not just like eating a loaf of soggy bread.
Yeah, I'll have to look more into it, but apparently in Bagheria there is a festival of Sincione, third week of November. I would have to check and see if there's, we're really hoping with the COVID numbers going down that these kinds of festivals will come back, because it's a great way to see Italy. Like whenever you go to Italy, and it doesn't matter when you go, check. Here's like the pros and cons of having the internet. And I would say, here's a good pro. Check online to find out if there are any festivals going on in that town, and just kind of insert yourself into these local festivals, because it's a great way to get some great food at great prices and really also see part of the culture. In addition, the other is the granita, the Sicilian shaved ice, which is a little bit, you know, whether it was invented by the Arabs and brought to Sicily, or perhaps it was, it's an Italian thing, you know, because apparently Romans were also, you know, putting flavoring, you know, sugar syrup on ice and eating it.
So what's your story about Mount Etna?
Yeah, so they would hike up Mount Etna. You know, where do you get ice in Sicily? You know, it's a hot climate.
Right.
They would hike up Mount Etna in the winter and cart away a whole bunch of ice or snow from the top of Mount Etna. And then, you know, you have it there also in the summertime.
If it's ice, shave it.
Shave it.
Yeah.
And add usually like a simple syrup, like a sugar syrup and
almond. Oh, almond.
Or lemon. And it's often had in Sicily, it's often eaten at breakfast. You have that with a cornetto, with a sweet brioche, like a sweet croissant. That's, you know, breakfast of champions.
Yeah.
So I think Dacia Maraini is a really interesting writer, someone to look for. I think that you'll find her books around. You know, as I said, The Silent Duchess is probably one of the best known. But I really enjoyed this Bagheria because I like the way she wrote kind of different perspectives as a child and as an adult looking back.
She also, from what I recall, she also grew up, am I using the right word? Polyglot, right?
Yes.
So she grows up reading Emily Dickinson in English. I've heard interviews with her. Her English is excellent.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if she, the Polish connection. That's
her grandmother.
Her grandmother's, yes. Polish.
Yeah. So I think though, that's an important point. And that's the thing that I forgot, that I was forgetting, which is that.
What archery?
Maraini as an Italian, but she sees herself kind of more as a citizen of the world. And she can be very critical of Italy. And she'll say the reason she's putting this spotlight or this magnifying glass on the flaws of Italy so that it can improve. She's not doing it to just like bust on Italy, but it is a country I think she loves and that she keeps coming back to, kind of like Sicily, like Bagheria, but that she also is very much aware of the problems and the flaws. I mean, she talks about the mafia and Bagheria, that this is...
Well, and also just vanilla corruption. You know, the idea that there's a ton of... This is a beautiful old town in Sicily, and they start knocking down homes. Someone gets paid off so that they can build schools, and there aren't enough children. The schools are basically empty, so these brand new kind of 1950s... concrete monsters that are empty, and they're basically turning it into a little shanty town.
But that's what I was gonna, I mean, and certainly you can see based on her childhood from these very kind of interesting idiosyncratic parents, and also her childhood of growing up in Japan and being in a concentration camp for 3 years and then returning to Sicily and studying in Florence and living and traveling abroad. That film that we can't get because it's not available streaming in the United States, that I Was Born Traveling.
We haven't mentioned that, so maybe we should mention that. Yes, there is a documentary out there, I Was Born Traveling, I think. Yeah.
Yes, I Was Born Traveling, which is a documentary, and she's involved in the making of it. And so it's also her films, like 8mm films from the 60s and 70s with Moravia and whoever else, you know, Pasolini. But very much that idea of I was born on the move, you know? I think Bagheria, I guess maybe that's why I thought this would make an interesting book. For someone who is so rootless, there's some reason she keeps coming back to Bagheria and maybe, you know, also the Silent Duchess. I mean, she does trace that line back through that, you know, back to that place, Bagheria, and its importance. So Now I feel like having pizza.
All right.
All right.
I think we're done for this time.
I know where we can get pizza like that.
Oh, La Sicilia.
Yeah. All right. All right. So until the next time, which hopefully will be sooner than this
one.
We won't have as long. We'll have some interviews coming up and some other books, including some books that were originally written in English.
Excellent. Alla prossima.
Ciao, ciao.